And it's an incredibly important part of our town's history that we want to embrace and share with our community. Attendances and apologies. We've had an apology from Councillor Quinton this evening, and Councillor Wilson isn't with us. He's obviously not able to be here either. Declarations of interest for tonight's agenda. Item 8.1, which relates to 1 Surrey Street. As many of you have known, since the Museum of Perth has first expressed interest in 1 Surrey Street, I've declared an impartiality interest for any items relating to that property. After I became aware that my husband's cousin's husband is on the board of the Museum of Perth, so I think you'd all agree that that is a very remote connection. I'd just like to point out I have had some criticism in the community for having an interest in this matter, with the implication being that I should not participate in decision-making on this item. Declaring the impartiality interest is not a requirement, particularly given the tenuous nature of my connection. However, I hope that in doing so, people will see it as testament to my commitment to being open and transparent on all of these issues. Just so people are aware, under the Act, impartiality interests, when declared by a councillor, there's a requirement for the councillor to continue to participate in decisions and debate on that particular topic. It's only after disclosure of financial and proximity interests that there is a requirement for people to excuse themselves and not participate. The impartiality interests recognise that everybody has interests and relationships which affect their views and the way they think and feel, and so an impartiality interest is significantly different from the other interests that require someone to remove themselves from the room. So once again, I have an impartiality interest for this item due to that remote connection. Also, item 8.3, which is the JDAP Bassendean Hotel modification to their development application. Both myself and Catherine Hamilton, Councillor Catherine Hamilton, are members of the JDAP panel. So we'll continue to participate in the briefing this evening, but may excuse ourselves from the decision-making next week in advance of being decision-makers on the JDAP when that is scheduled. We've already dealt with item 4, which is a confidential business between 6 and 7pm this evening. So just go on to announcements. So I think everybody, when they came in, I saw you sign in and hopefully you all scanned the Safe WA app as well. Just want to make everybody aware that tonight's briefing session is recorded as always, and so those recordings are uploaded to the town's website and made public. So there's no protection offered for anything that people may choose to say in this meeting and that is recorded. Also want to take the opportunity to highlight that the month of August is going to be dedicated to consultation on the future of our town centre. So as many of you would know, preliminary engagement has already been undertaken with local businesses, property owners, community members, community groups, the development industry and state government agencies. And this has been used to develop a draft plan. But before Council considers a plan for our town centre, we want feedback from the broader community on this draft that has been formulated from that community input we've already received. So that engagement's going to include open days, static displays at various locations around the town and a survey. So I'd really like to encourage everybody in our community that cares about the future of our town to engage in that process during the month of August. And finally, thank you to everyone who is here this evening. We welcome attendance of community members to our briefing session and encourage your input. There are some items on tonight's agenda that it's clear that there are some individuals in our community have very strong views on and feel very passionately about. I'd just like to remind people that given the emotions that there are around some of these topics, it's really important up front for me to remind everybody that our conduct is really important and there are certain expectations of people's conduct at these meetings. So that the meeting is conducted efficiently and effectively, we need to make sure that there's a safe environment for all involved, staff, councillors and community members. So I'd just like to remind everybody of the need to be respectful and courteous and to have due regard for individual differences and rights. So with that, We will go on to public question time and statements. So this is a briefing session, so there's no decisions being made by Council tonight, and Council hasn't yet considered these items. So members of the public are welcome to make statements on any of the agenda items. We have 15 minutes allocated for that on tonight's agenda. You'll have up to three minutes to speak to your agenda item. So if there's something that you would like to address Council on, I would invite you to raise your hand. I can call you one at a time to the microphone, but I'd ask you to state the agenda item that you wish to speak to. Let us know your name and then speak to your item. Yes, Ms. Carter.
Thank you. Adam here. Obviously for agenda item
8.1.
It's a one, sorry, Street, at any rate. Here we are. Yes. Agenda item 8.1. I'd like to know if the submissions that were public submissions were made are going to be accessible in full for people who wish to view them.
So could I just clarify, when you say the public submissions, do you mean the feedback from the community or do you mean the expression of interest proposals?
No, I mean the feedback from the community. The community was invited to do their feedback, and there were invitations on Facebook as well as on media, on the website.
Our CEO, have you had conversations around that with the executive?
No, I haven't. But with regards to the submissions, they're currently in a confidential attachment. Is there a reason why we wouldn't?
Through you, Madam Mayor, we certainly could. It would require a fair amount of redacting just to sort of ensure people's personal details were not made public, but if Council would prefer to have that information publicly available, that can be organised during the week.
Thank you. And did you have another question?
That's all.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Mr. Bridges.
Yeah, Paul Bridges, 150 West Road, Bassendean, and I'm speaking on the Surrey Street item. Look, when Council asked for community feedback on the proposal to dispose of the site, it very clearly stated on the website that all submissions would be made public. Now, following up from Jenny's comment, so why on earth are they all confidential, and why are we now having this discussion? Yes, it would be possible to release them to the public, but will they be released to the public with the name of the person that put the submission? Because all of us that put in a submission was on the basis that all of those submissions would be made public. Now, all of a sudden, they're confidential.
Yeah, and thanks for bringing
made that decision.
Thanks for bringing that. Hold on a moment. Thanks for bringing that to attention. I'm not sure that that was intentional.
There were some people that made a submission that did request that their details not be made public. So, as Mr. Gibson indicated, we could certainly look at redacting necessary information, but making them public for the council meeting next week. So we'd issue those on Friday. So apologies. So
why would you have a situation where anyone who's invited to make a submission is informed that the content will be made public, and now you're saying that some people didn't want it made public? What's the point of having public submissions if they're not public?
Yeah, well, we would have to respect individual people's privacy.
I think there's a difference as well, Mr. Bridges. I think there's a difference as well between publishing someone's name and if they've had their home address and things like that provided.
I understand your home address thing.
Yeah, and that's what our CEO is referring to in terms of making sure that people's private details aren't made public.
But once again, we have a situation where people are invited to make submissions, where they're informed that they'll be made public, yet it's a confidential document.
Thank you. You've made your point, and we've heard it, and they're going to be made public.
Thank you.
Yes.
Oh, good evening. I'm speaking to Surrey Street. So I understand as part of the submission that was put in by Perth Museum that there would be an undertaking of $50,000 a year to be spent over 4 years, which is $200,000. And my question is, when I have a look at the comment on the briefing session, page 5 of 71. In considering the matter, the following is relevant. Well, unfortunately, I don't see anything that relates to the fact that there was a $375,000 lottery grant that was allocated to Surrey Street, as well as, I understand, at least $100,000 that was left over from the sale of Masonic Lodge, possibly $150,000. That makes up $500,000. So my understanding is we were prepared, Bassendean Historical Society, with their submissions, knowing that we had $500,000 to spend, and now it's being looked at for someone that's going to spend $200,000. So it doesn't make sense. There's a huge discrepancy there. And why was it not mentioned on page 5 of 71 in considering the matter, this is relevant? Because to me, that's very relevant.
So the officers may wish to comment as well. And Mr. Rees-Harley may wish to speak to it later as well. There is a difference between the local government and a private entity delivering this project. The $200,000, my understanding, that has been proposed by the Museum of Perth is in the absence of grants. Their intention is to apply for additional grant money, so it would be in excess of the $200,000. The Lotteries West grant was tied to specific requirements, which one of which was the time frame, which was not going to be able to be met, but it also was tied to the community space, Mr. Gibson. Yeah, we'll seek clarity on that again for you for next week. But is there anything that any of the officers would like to add to Ms. Collins' question?
I need to say the Lottery West grant was for a specific purpose. I think that the purpose for which it was intended was subject to a previous council agenda item and paper some time ago. So that door has now closed. What we're looking at now is quite a different proposal. So the Lottery West grant has lapsed. In respect to the Masonic Lodge, I would have to take that on notice.
Yes, so I'm wondering where that money's mysteriously gone.
We can find out.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. White has offered to respond to that. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I can advise that the funds remaining from the sale of the Masonic Lodge remain with the town and in the land and buildings infrastructure reserve.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. So as we've heard, the town's first choice in terms of the Surrey Street was to retain the site and to renovate. That grant
would you, sorry, would you mind speaking up a little bit?
Is this not working?
That's actually
that's
more for the recording.
No.
Yeah. That's it.
No.
Great.
Yeah, so a grant was obtained for $375,000 because the town had initially sought to retain the site and to renovate it. That was the first choice. That fell through. Then we moved on to exploring other opportunities. Now, that was resolved at the November 2020 council meeting. And what was sought there, and this is the resolution, is that we would have regard to financial, heritage restoration, and community access. Now, this does come down to the numbers. In terms of financial, and it has been acknowledged in the agenda for this evening, that the transaction isn't a commercial transaction. So it's going to be disposed of to whomever. I mean, this doesn't have to be about the Museum of Perth, and as regards your impartiality announcement, I think that's perfectly fine, given that this submission goes to disposing of the site to anyone, regardless of their identity. And certainly in terms of disposing of it to somebody on something other than commercial terms. So in terms of what can occur to the site and what would satisfy those criteria, so if one turns to the heritage restoration, that was covered by the Lottery West grant. It is to a certain extent, but to a lesser extent, being covered by the current proposal that has gone out to advertising. So we're comparing the $375,000 to $200,000 plus additional grant money, whatever that may be. So from a financial perspective, it's not great. So that's the heritage restoration side. Financially, the town could do better. It was offered as a suggestion by administration that there could be a subdivision and that would then facilitate the restoration and retention of the Pension of Yard Cottage itself. In terms of the community access, and this is one which is comes back to the numbers, it's only going to be open for one day a month. That's my understanding under the proposal. Is that not what was put forward?
So the proposal is to have it open as often as possible, at least once a week.
At least once a week. Yeah. Was that what was advertised on the town
website?
That's
included in the submission by the Museum of Perth, which is an attachment to tonight's agenda.
Oh, so that has changed?
No.
Sorry.
The requirement when it was put out for expression of interest was at least once a month as per its current opening, but the submission by the Museum of Perth has identified as often as possible at least once a week. Where's Reece? Yes.
So yep. There's a guarantee of weekly access as opposed to monthly access.
Well, the requirement is still once a month, but the proposal is to have it open more frequently than that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in terms of that, then one turns to the community consultation. So I mean, at the outset, the town was looking to satisfy those criteria, financial, heritage restoration, and community access. So, I mean, those are admirable things to seek to do. We've gone out for the expressions of interest. We've got back what we've received. And we would say that is inadequate in addressing those particular criteria that were identified. That has been communicated to the council by those that have put in submissions. So I think there were 71 submissions received. That's quite a high number. I mean, people, you know, go about their daily lives. They don't necessarily have time for putting submissions in. So I would say that's quite a large turnout. And of those 71, as I understand it, 83% of people were opposed to the disposal. So previously the town has stepped back from the lottery West approach. As has been identified rightly by administration, it is open for council to now step back from what is currently proposed. And in light of the community consultation and what has been received from the community, it would be suggested that in order to give any weight to the advertising process, the council would seriously consider that which has come back from the community and would look for alternate proposals. And that may well, and given this is a briefing session, no decision is to be made tonight, there might be some discussion amongst council for alternate proposals.
I'm going to have to ask you to wind up.
Because
you've had 3 minutes.
Such as the lease of the site. Say the proponent is prepared to put in $200,000. If one, for example, were to give them a 20-year lease, that seems to be a fairly reasonable deal in terms of them having to pay $10,000 a year for them to use those premises.
Okay, thank you, but I'm just going to have to stop you there. Just wanted to go back to one of the points you made about the Lottery West grant, and I think you were implying that was going to largely cover the restoration works, which was not, in fact, the case. So council was very committed to pursuing this project. Many iterations of council prior to this one have been pursuing restoration of that site. When it was put out for tender, the prices that came back were well in excess of $375,000. As we expected, we didn't intend for that to cover the whole costs. But to say that we gave that back and therefore the $200,000 plus some funding from that the Museum of Perth or any other organisation might achieve would cover the restoration costs for the local government to deliver that project, that's just not the case.
Well, yeah.
I'm sorry, it's not the opportunity to respond here at the moment. If you'd like to have some more dialogue about it during the week, that would be very welcome to, but I just want to give other people the opportunity to have their say.
Yeah, look, it's expensive, it's just a matter of priorities. If the priorities
it is a matter of priorities, you're correct. Anybody else would like to say? Yes, Ms. Jacobson.
Nottingham Jacobson, Spartan Parade, Bassendean. Can you hear it?
Yes.
I'm just sort of fact-checking here. I've got a query regarding the expression of interest process. Was it or wasn't it actually forbidden for the applicants to collude?
Sorry?
To collude.
Interest, collusion between applicants.
I don't have an answer for that question. Is anybody... I don't think a partnership would be discouraged in any way. That would be a
mutually beneficial.
So there's nothing in the that process that actually prevents collusion between different applicants?
Through Madam Mayor, as you've said, there would be nothing stopping a partnership. That doesn't necessarily amount to collusion. It would just be two groups effectively forming one proposal, and there would be no in principle concern with that.
Okay. Would you be able to actually give me that response as a written response via email sometime during the week before the next council meeting, if possible?
In writing,
yes.
Yet there was nothing against forming a partnership.
Just about the potential of collusion between applicants in the expression of interest process. Sorry, back to you.
Yeah, that would be great. Thank you. Thank you. Last question for now, because we've already gone over our 15 minutes. We need to get on with the briefing.
Island Street, Bassendean. When the property was purchased, it was purchased because of the Prince of the Guard College, which had incredible historical significance, heritage significance. The house, if I recall, was never considered to have any heritage value. Now, can I ask, when did the house get put on the, I presume it's just a local town's heritage list?
No.
Certainly not the state one, I think. When was that put on the list?
We might have to get back to you with the date. I'm not sure if we have that information on hand, do we, Mr. Gibson?
We don't, sorry, Madam Mayor. But we, the listing is the site. So the site is 1 Surrey Street. That site has been listed. That site contains both the cottage and the residence.
Yeah, but the heritage, the fixing up of the house, which was noted in the first lot of report the council gave for the, on the purchase, only mentioned the house is having problems with the bit that's stuck on the back. Okay, and if something's going to be fixed for heritage purposes, it is only the Pensioner Guard Cottage, as I believe. Now, when it was decided that the house had to be fixed up and given heritage value?
So maybe
that's
we can respond to that
when
during
did
the
that
week.
Happen?
Yeah, so we'll get a response to you during the week. All right, everyone. We might move on then to the deputations. So we have two deputations this evening. First of all, we have Mr. John McCauley, I believe it is, who's speaking on item 8.4, which relates to the unauthorised works at 50 Faulkner Way in Bassendean. So, welcome. If you'd like, you can either stand at the microphone or sit at the table, either way. So you've got up to 10 minutes to speak to council, and as I mentioned to you on the phone, there's the opportunity for councillors to ask you questions at the end, if that's all right with you.
Cheers. Yeah. Just appearing on behalf of the owners, we erected the construction, but from what I gathered when we had an interaction with the officers, it was the complaint that came, or the observation from a concerned citizen, was the aesthetics of it. And if any of the councillors had a chance to look at it, we think it's an attractive construction. It's structurally sound. We think it adds to the area, not diminishes it. So that's my 10 minutes.
You're very efficient.
That's it, for sure.
Is there anything that councillors would like to ask Mr. McCauley? Councillor Hamilton?
The height of the structure that houses the boat, it seems to be the highest structure in that street. Would I be correct in that?
Oh, it would be, yes, for sure.
Okay.
And it was to accommodate the boat. Because it's got nowhere else to put the boat, but it is obscured by the screen around the outside, so it doesn't present as an eyesore, I don't think.
So the officer's comment, there is comment somewhere around here about built form and character. I'm guessing that you would agree that, given the height of the structure, that it probably doesn't fit with the rest of the housing in that area?
It is higher than most of the constructions there, but that was to accommodate the boat. We really couldn't do anything that made it lower than that. there was a suggestion we could cut it back by 3 metres from the boundary to that to make it, for whatever reason, I couldn't see
a
sense.
That's a setback, isn't it?
Setback, yeah, 3 metres to that. To me, that didn't take away or add to the quality of the construction.
So I'm correct in thinking that the structure goes right up to the entry gate, doesn't it? The
yes.
boat structure. So it goes right up to the fence line.
Yeah, it's about 500 from there.
And also the adjoining carport area also adjoins the fence line, is that right?
Not on the fence line, no. It's away from the fence line, about 500.
Okay.
So.
But that is less than what is standard, is that right?
Well, you can get where it goes to development application. So you can, instead of being a metre, you can bring it back 500.
So these works were done without an application?
Oh, no, there was application put in, oh, for sure.
So it must have varied the conditions, is that right?
I don't think it varied the condition. I think we put in for 500 from
so
the boundary.
So, Councillor Hampton, maybe we can ask the staff when we come to this item about the application.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Will I wait for them all?
Anything further, councillors? Yes, Councillor Gadgil.
Maybe this may be more for the staff. I do notice you've put your very attractive tree in a coloured photo on the TPO we're going to discuss tonight. I'm just wondering, just with items like this, why we couldn't actually have imagery
there
in
there.
There
are in the attachments. There's colour photos.
Where have I missed?
No, only drawings.
Are you sure?
Do you want on here to have a glance at?
Oh, I've only got a hard copy.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, yes, bring it up on there.
Yes.
Okay, that's not in the hard copy.
Photos, weren't there? Yeah. Yeah.
That's okay.
There are
I'll look online.
Does that gentleman see it on here?
Can you show me the photos, Madam CEO? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if there's nothing further...
get off.
Thank you.
I was hoping to be somewhat more polite than that, but thank you for your time. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Cheers.
Okay, and a second deputation on item 8.1, which is 1 Surrey Street, from Mr. Rhys Harley from the Museum of Perth. Welcome, Mr. Harley. Once again, 10 minutes, up to 10 minutes, and then I imagine there'll be questions from councillors.
Thank you. Good evening. Thanks for the opportunity to address council this evening. I just wanted to state a few things and then open up for questions. The Museum of Perth is a not-for-profit incorporated association. We are a charitable organisation registered with the ACNC. We've got a constitution, members and a board of directors. We have paid staff. And we've got offices in Perth as well as in Fremantle and Bunbury. Since we were established, we have run 16 exhibitions on different topics. One of our recent exhibitions actually was on a Bassendean boy who was a World War I soldier. And, you know, we're really interested in celebrating the history of Western Australia. Something that we've identified in recent years is that right around Western Australia, there are lots of very important heritage buildings owned by local government, state government, and other organisations that aren't in the best condition. And that's how we came across 1 Surrey Street. And as we started to look into the history of it, we could see that there were lots of proposals that had been put forward by the community, and for whatever reason, they'd not come to fruition. So, you know, we've responded to the expression of interest process and provided our vision, which really aligns to the vision that the community has been proposing for quite some time. We would like to see the Pensioner Guard Cottage open much more frequently. We'd obviously want to discuss this with adjacent neighbours, but from our perspective, if we were on site, running a local history research centre at the property, there's no reason why it couldn't be open 5 days a week. That might be too much for the neighbours, and so we would obviously speak to them about that. But we would be happy to open the Pensioner Guard Cottage as often as possible, as often as the community would like. The plan that we put forward to council was that we would restore the residence, 1893, on the left-hand side, and that we would use the rear portion of that property as research offices and then use the front portion of the property in the oldest part of the building as a museum gallery space. The Pensioner Guard Cottage itself as most people know, doesn't need a great deal of restoration work, though there are some aesthetic issues in order to make sure that it's restored and looks as it did when it was built. But it's the residents, really, that is in dire need of works. We've got a ceiling at risk of collapse. We've got structural cracks. There are issues in terms of the roof timbers and the structure of the way that the roof has been built. There's concrete cancer. There's all kinds of problems, as anyone who's read the engineer's report can see. One of the complicating factors, as has been highlighted by an earlier speaker, is that it's the entire site, not just the Pensioner Guard Cottage, that's State Heritage listed. The site was included on the State Heritage Register in 1994, so it's not new. It's been on the State Heritage list for a long time. And these things can often be a bit confusing, because sometimes even modern buildings, very modern buildings, 70s and 60s and 50s buildings, can be included on the State Heritage Register. It's not just old buildings always. What that means is that any works whatsoever done on the site, whether or not that was significant tree lopping or demolishing a modern extension or replacing an asbestos siding for timber siding, all of that needs to go through a planning process through the council and be referred to the State Heritage Council for their feedback as well. So it makes the restoration work more complex, more costly. We're happy that a very professional firm called Element WA, who are heritage specialists, have come forward and offered their services to help guide us through the restoration process if we are selected to carry it out. I've been a little bit disappointed at some of the discussion that I've seen on this item, particularly on social media. We know that can sometimes be a place where people vent all of their fears and concerns, and can also be very informative. You can actually get some really good information out of that process of engaging with community members, and I've tried to do that as best as possible throughout the last couple of weeks and months, but there is certainly there's some information out there among community members which I'm not sure is entirely accurate. Our proposal is on our website. Our proposal is an attachment to tonight's agenda. We're not a private company. We're not proposing to establish a call centre at the property. We're not proposing to subdivide the property. There's nothing in the rules that would stop two community organisations speaking to each other about making a joint proposal. That's not collusion and it's not illegal. It's actually probably would have been a better outcome for the community. So there are a range of things that have unsettled me a little bit in this process, but we are still committed to carrying out the works. We do hope that we're given the opportunity to do so. But if it doesn't come to pass, that's okay, because as I said in my opening statement, there are lots of heritage properties at risk around Western Australia. And really our desire was to restore this property and to open it up to the community, because it has been closed for too long. We'd really like to partner with the town and the local community to do that. And I'm very happy to answer any questions that elected members or community members had on the topic.
Thank you. And thank you for being here again tonight. I know it's challenging, particularly when there is a level of concern in the community. And I do want to thank you, because I have seen you spend a lot of time responding to concerns on social media, on the radio, in the local newspaper. So that's been time-consuming, and you have consistently remained professional and inclusive, and I've seen you reach out to our community groups with offers of working together. So really appreciate the efforts that you have made, because I recognise it hasn't always been met with the kind of reception that we would have liked you to have had. I do have a question for you. One of the things that has been raised by some members of the community is the Museum of Perth's financial capacity to deliver on the proposal. So I understand that the financials up until 2019 are on your website, and I believe the town staff have had some communication with you.
Yep.
Is it possible, even if it's not available publicly, for councillors to have access to the most recent financials?
Yes, no problems. We obviously haven't closed off our June 30 statements from a couple of weeks ago, but the last financial period from 2020, more than happy to provide those, and profit and loss statements, as recently as we can. What they demonstrate is that we run at a small surplus per annum of between $30,000 and $40,000 to $60,000. We've got a total operating budget of between $350,000 as we were growing and up to $500,000 per annum. We've got 10 staff across our three locations. A commitment of about $50,000 per annum towards the restoration of 1 Surrey Street would represent about 12.5% of our annual budget, so it's not a huge sum for us. I did mention to an officer it's about the salary of an administrative assistant 3 or 4 days a week, so it's not a great amount of money in terms of our budget. But I can understand community members wanting to make sure that any custodian of the property had the capacity to deliver. As was mentioned previously as well, the commitment that we made was surplus from our operating budget, we could commit around $50,000 per year, in addition to any grants that were available. There are potentially state heritage grants available, given it's a state registered property. There are Lottery West grants potentially available if we can make a fresh pitch to them and pitch a new vision. So our commitment is from our own budget over and above what we may be able to acquire in a grant.
Great.
Or grants.
Thank you. Councillor Hamilton.
The constitution of your organisation, am I correct? The very last item is winding up. And am I correct in reading that any property, if Perth Museum, Museum of Perth was wound up, that any property is then gifted or forwarded on to another organisation of similar aims? Is that right?
That's correct.
Do you want to just expand on that further?
That's a legal requirement now for incorporated associations, and all incorporated associations have been required to put that in their constitutions, which is that if an organisation winds up and it has assets, it's required to give those assets to a like organisation with similar objects or to a relevant local or state government. The other thing that's been discussed as part of this proposal is that there may be a caveat on the property title, which would require it to be open to the public, and also that if we didn't uphold our end of the bargain, then the town could repurchase back the property for a dollar, so we could handball it back to you to finish the restoration. Those are additional safeguards, I think, that should provide some confidence to community members that if we don't do what we said we're going to do, then really the ball's back in the town's court.
Okay. Can I ask?
Yep.
Now, I have been reading about Sheraton House. Is it Perth or North Perth? North Perth?
Sheraton Street is in East Perth. Well, it's known as East Perth. It's officially the suburb of Perth. It's one of those weird little suburbs. Yeah.
So I've read that you're going to take over the management order of that property. The restoration work required for that property is extensive, if my reading is correct. It's perhaps almost as much work as what Surrey Street is. Would that be correct?
No, it's not actually. Cheriton Street is a state government owned property. It was the station master's house for East Perth train station. We've written to the State Minister for Lands, Tony Booty, and we've asked if the state government would consider gifting us the property.
Oh, okay.
It's not on the basis of a lease. The reason for that is that actually, quite similarly to Surrey Street, there have been, for the last 20 years, plans in the local community for that to be restored as a local community centre. And in fact, the City of Vincent invested about $400,000 restoring the property. And just so that you're aware, $400,000 got them a new roof, a new electrics, but it didn't finish the job. That's an important fact to consider. So that was, I believe, under Alana McTiernan when she was mayor, and the community have been putting forward a proposal to run a community garden and local community centre and meeting facility, but it didn't come to fruition. The council then voted to hand the management of the property back to the state government, The risk is, because the property is not heritage listed, that it will be demolished and apartments built. And so we've said to the state government, to the state minister for lands, that if we were gifted the property, we would restore it, we would run a local history centre, we would move our Perth operations, where we currently pay rent in the city, we would move them to a property that we owned, okay, and we would restore the property. Now, differently to Surrey Street, this property has a new roof and new electrics. Surrey Street is actually more work. So the work required at Cheriton Street is to repair and replace the ceiling, gyprock ceiling, to rebuild the front veranda, and to replace windows, rotten windows and door frames around the property. And significantly, it's not heritage listed, so the process of doing those restorations is considerably easier.
Okay. I did read the letters of support as well from the community there.
Yep.
So congratulations on that one. If you restore that one, that would be a lovely addition to that area.
Councillor, I'm going to give Councillor Willie the opportunity to ask a question.
Yes, thanks for being with us here tonight, Mr. Harley.
Can you speak up a little bit,
Councillor? Yes, sure. So I note too that the Museum of Perth has a status as a deductible gift recipient.
No, we don't, actually. No, we don't. We haven't gone through the process of registering as a tax-deductible organisation, but we are registered with the Australian Charities and Not-for-Profits Commission as a charity.
Okay. And the West Australian Historical Society, that's...
The West Australian Historical Society are registered as a deductible gift recipient organisation. It's not a particularly difficult process, and we are... looking to do to register this year. The only reason why we haven't is, to be frank, up until recently, we've never really chased donations in a big way, because we, unlike many other historical associations, have delivered and created a business model which has provided us with operating revenue so that we didn't have to chase donations and we didn't have to door knock to get $500 here or $1,000 there, because our training programs delivered a profit which enabled us to carry out the work. But it's a good thing to do to register in case anyone wishes to give you some money and get a tax receipt for it.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking of particularly those projects that are close to the community's heart, where people might decide to make donations on a regular basis.
Correct.
So it's another opportunity, clearly. Thank you.
Any other questions, councillors?
Do you mind if I say one more thing?
Yes, of course.
Thank you. I just wanted to talk about the National Trust, if I could quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that there's been a discussion in the past about the potential of the town gifting the property to the trust for them to restore, and as I understand it, they've demurred because it was a big job and they've got lots of other things to do as well. But I would point to two examples where a property being in the hands of the National Trust does not guarantee public access. So I'd point to the mill manager's house in Jarrodale, which is a very beautiful old weatherboard property, one of the first properties built up in Jarrodale, owned by the Trust. It's on a very large block of land right in the heart of the city. That's currently rented to a private individual. It's their home. The Trust have spent quite a bit of money restoring it. Interestingly, when the Trust put out an expression of interest process, the town submitted an application to lease the property on a peppercorn, because the town of Serpentine Jarrodale, or the Shire, wanted to use it as a base for their walking trail on the Gooralong Brook, I believe it is. They wanted to establish that as a tourism enterprise or a bit of a feature. The Trust chose the fee-paying residential tenant over the town as a tenant there, so there's now no public access to that property. The other one is Bridgedale House, which is in Bridgetown. Very important building right up on the hill overlooking the bridge in Bridgetown, one of the first settler cottages down there. That was run by the local Bridgetown Historical Society as a living history museum. So people could go there and they could see what it would have been like to live in Bridgedale House. The Historical Society spent a great deal of time filling that property with antiques and memorabilia from the house and installing exhibitions on the history of the property. The Trust removed them from the property and have now leased that property out to a psychologist who's paying them a commercial rent. and so there is now no longer any public access to Bridgedale House in Bridgetown. The reason for that is that the trust are strapped for cash, and if someone is willing to give them money for a property, well, they need it because they've got so many other properties to restore. So just because a property is in the hands of the National Trust does not necessarily guarantee that it will be established as a museum or open to the public. I think that's an important thing to consider as well.
Really interesting. Thank you. I think that's all the questions for tonight. I appreciate you being here and your time once again. And as you know, the decision will be made next week around this item. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, councillors, there's no more deputations, so we'll move on to the reports. The first one is item 8.1, which is related to 1 Surrey Street. So can I ask our Director of Community Planning to first of all speak to this item?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Probably not a great deal to add, although I will reiterate that the matter has recently been advertised and we received over 70 submissions. As the report identifies, most of those were in fact objecting to the proposal. And I received a call yesterday from a Ms. Eileen Bowman of Railway Parade who requested that I advise the meeting that although she did not make a formal submission, she objects to the proposal. So councillors can take that into consideration. But ultimately, council needs to decide, in light of the submissions received, whether it wishes to progress with the proposed disposition or whether it wants to choose to not dispose the property as part of the current process. If council does in fact resolve the latter, then it would need to consider the future of the site as part of a separate process.
Thank you. Questions, councillors? Councillor Hamilton?
With the submissions, this is through the chair to the officer, with the submissions, I note that there's a significant number from clearly outside the town. Would that be able next week to clarify? Because many of these submissions from outside the town, that's all well and good, but they're not ratepayers. So I'd be interested in having the breakdown of residents as opposed to entities from outside the town, if that would be okay.
Through you, Madam Mayor, yes, we can provide them.
And also, I did read some of the submissions who had put down the bottom of their submission that they didn't want their name and address released. So some of the submitters did actually say name and address. So I can't remember which ones, but I do remember reading that. So if that's going to be released, if they can be redacted out, that would be great. I'll leave someone else to ask for a question. I do have another one, but I just need to find it.
Councillor McWilliam?
It's not a meeting. I don't have to stand up, do I?
Well, it is a meeting, but it's not a formal council meeting.
Okay. So just looking at the dot points on 6 of 71 down the bottom there, the final dot point is, even with a project instrument such as a formal contract of sale and payment, the disposal of the site does represent a degree of uncertainty and does come with at least some risk. That risk needs to be weighed against the relative risks and issues of other options. I just would like it if you could possibly explain the risks for the community, in view of the community's views, what are the risks?
For this particular proposal?
Yes, thank you.
Through Madam Mayor, I suppose the risk would be that the funding that Mr. Harley has advised would likely be available might be unavailable, which may impact the timeliness of the delivery, whether there was an ability to procure relevant trades, that might impact the timing of the delivery. If there was some default on the terms of the contract, that would require, in most cases, the town to pursue a legal course of action, which, if it ran its full course, would probably end up in the magistrate's court. Obviously, based on what we've been told, there does seem to be at least some funding available, so we'd be very much hoping that that wasn't an outcome. But as I've said before on this matter, there is a leap of faith because it would be in someone else's ownership and custodianship. So that is what is referred to in terms of the risks.
So I have another question, which is regarding the statutory requirements. I noticed that it talks about proposed disposal as an exempt disposition for the purposes of the Act on the basis that it would be to a charitable, benevolent, religious, cultural, educational, recreational, sporting or other like nature group, and the members are not entitled or permitted to receive any pecuniary profit from the body's transactions. How does this relate to perhaps the difference between a contract of sale, which is what has been proposed, I understand, or a peppercorn lease? And why is one more preferable than the other?
Through Madam Mayor, there's broadly no difference between a sale and a lease. Both are considered dispositions of property for the purpose of the Act. This reference under statutory requirements is simply saying that because of the nature of Museum of Perth, the disposition would be exempt. If it was not exempt, council would also need to consider a land valuation. Because it's exempt, council does not need to consider a land valuation, which in this instance wouldn't be particularly relevant anyway because the proposed purchase price is $1 and it's not a commercial transaction. But all that's a moot point because it's exempt.
Yeah. So I guess in getting this explanation, I'm hoping to create more understanding in the community that we are not giving it away for a dollar in some sort of frivolous way, that this is the sort of transaction that occurs on a very frequent basis across Australia in relation to a range of things, whether it's peppercorn rents for men's sheds or whatever it happens to be, or this kind of contract, and in fact probably occurs all over the Commonwealth.
So, Councillor Fleming, you may be verging on debating this item at the moment, so if you have another question, you're welcome to ask it.
No, I'm done.
Councillor Gadgil.
Yes, thank you, Your Worship. Just two dot points that are in the report. The first one, whilst a town-owned asset, there is no clear purpose for it in terms of community amenity, particularly in its current state, and then the one further below that. Typically, local governments will only own land where there is generally delivers a benefit for the community. Whilst the site does accommodate heritage value, there is limited capability for the site, if retained by the town, to deliver benefit to the community beyond its heritage value. Just in relation to those statements, so certainly in my time on council, it may have even started under Tina Klein when she was mayor and followed through by me, there was a great endeavourment to make the proposal that went forward for the restoration of it community use. I'm just wanting to confirm, was there aspects of community use as part of that renovation or restoration that was proposed by the town?
Broadly, the proposal I think that was settled on and advertised originally was known as Option 2C, which included a proposal to restore the residence in its current front four rooms of the residence, which is the heritage component of it, and have that available as community space for various purposes, and also to construct a new infant health clinic.
Well, I think you're stepping ahead a little bit because that came at a later stage.
No, it didn't.
It came at a later stage. Councillor Hamilton, you went on council. So there was a proposal for the restoration to be done, which in fact we got the Lottery West funding for the restoration that we're ready to go with. So I'm just wondering, with those two statements in saying that there wouldn't be community benefit accommodated at the site, I'm just wondering how, with those proposals, I mean, even with the later proposals.
Councillor Gadgil, I think
as well,
the statements relate to the site in its current state without there being significant investment to deliver those renovations.
Not the second point,
yes.
It does.
Just to clarify, I agree that the Lottery West funding was primarily to assist with the community aspects of the redevelopment, not in relation to the infield community.
Yes. Yeah.
Was that the extent of your question?
Well, no, I just want to clarify that there very much was intent to have community purpose.
I don't think there's any doubt there, Councillor Gangell,
well,
and everybody.
You're at the dot point there. Great.
Those two points should be read in the context of the current position, and that is after Council having decided not to proceed with the previous proposal, the last one being option 2C, following the completion of the tender process.
Yeah.
That is the context in which those two dot points are written, that is presently there in the plan for use of the site.
Thank you.
Councillor Bardi, did you have any questions?
Thank you.
Councillor Hamilton, you're welcome to ask more.
I do have questions that are relevant to this report, but I just want to clarify a statement made by Councillor Gangell. When I came onto Council, the plans for 2C were presented, including the building at the back. And can staff please clarify for me and for the audience too, those plans weren't significantly changed in their footprint. As far as I recall, the only thing changed was some internal walls to actually accommodate a new purpose for an infant.
You are correct,
at the back. Is that correct?
You are correct.
Right, okay. So moving on to my real question about the report.
Yeah, I didn't think you went here.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
There were some minor modifications with changes to doorways and
yes.
so on.
So when I came on Council in 2017, Plan 2C that was put in front of me already existed in its footprint, and the footprint was not altered at all.
But had a community use.
Councillor Gangell, just let Councillor Hamilton continue, and to clarify
okay.
your point, it did have a community use before and after the infant health clinic was proposed to be incorporated into that site.
So, thank you. I have, through the chair, sent a few emails to Mr. Gibson in the last day or two, and thank you. I've got response to one, so thank you for that. I did ask in the officer's report. Sorry, I just need to find it. And now I can't see it. Sorry. Okay, it's got here in the last dot point. The site is not permitted to be subdivided. That would be one of the conditions of sale. But you also indicated in your email when I asked about on-selling that was something that could be attended to in the condition of sale as well. You were going to put some words around that. Would that be correct?
Not quite. Through you, Madam Mayor, there was a query about the maintenance of the site.
That was one of the other queries, yes.
Which can be captured in the officer recommendation. We'll put some words together during the week on that. In terms of your query regarding the on sale, the response was that the proposed caveat allows the town to require any future owner to be subject to the same obligations as would be imposed on the Museum of Perth if Council resolves as such.
So subsequent to that email, I've read the constitution for the organisation, where clearly the constitution for the organisation has some conditions around the property being going to another entity of the same mindset. So would the staff be able to just have a look at that clause? I can send you the link to it in case there's any wording in the caveat contract that might be appropriate.
Through you, Madam Mayor, the caveat would still have full force of effect.
Okay, cool.
Councillor Gantry, can I ask your question?
Thank you, Your Worship. Just in relation to, there has been some discussion, obviously, about the impost that this financial impost that the site would contribute to the town. I'm just wondering, in relation to the financial impost, is the town's financial position so dire that we would not be in a position to actually do any substantial works to the building?
So, Councillor Ganji, you'd know that Council was presented with the tenders for the restoration and Council chose not to pursue any of them because of the financial costs. I guess it would be a matter of what Council chose to prioritise.
So outside of prioritising, there's no financial restrictions on the Council that would prohibit our current financial state from being able to restore the property.
I'm not really sure what you're asking exactly.
Well, Madam Mayor, you're saying that the reason why this hasn't gone ahead is because of the tenders that came in, and that it's a matter of prioritising for council if they wish to do the project. So what I'm asking is the current state of the financial affairs of the town such in a position that we would be able to prioritise or not this project?
Three, Madam Mayor. If I understand your question correctly, Councillor Gangell, I think, as councils are aware, the town's in a reasonably tight financial position. We've had some numerous discussions about that at the moment, which requires us to be frugal, as we should be when we're spending ratepayers' funds. But I think a project such as this, as we will recall from when the tender responses came in, would have required a considerable capital contribution from council to complete the project as it was proposed. And even in the absence of the infant health clinic, it would have still required substantial capital contribution from council. However, it would be difficult to find those funds, but as I think alluded to by the Mayor, there are always changes in priorities that can be made. So if it was a high priority of council, then other projects could be looked at and perhaps proceed with to facilitate funding.
Thank you.
Did you have another question, Councillor Hamilton?
Through the chair, in my second email to Mr. Gibson, I did ask about the potential of liaising with Museum of Perth about if there was scope for potentially a very long term lease, given the financial commitment that the property would require, as opposed to the current situation. But I'm thinking that this might be a difficult position, and I'm not sure where we stand with that. So have we got anywhere with thoughts on that one? Is it possible to have a discussion about what movement we've got in this proposal?
Through you, Madam Mayor, Council resolved to instigate an EOI process.
Mm-hmm.
That process has been started and finished. Council received two submissions in response to that. They selected a preferred party to engage with. They subsequently advertised the proposed disposition to that party, and that brings us to this present moment. It is appropriate that Council makes a decision to close out that EOI process and to make a decision on whether it supports the disposition of the property to the Museum of Perth or not. If the answer is the latter, it would be open to Council to start a new process. I don't think it's appropriate, though, that mid-process we start negotiating alternatives. If Council wanted to limit the responses to leases only, that is a decision that needed to be made before now. The Council was open to all forms of disposition. It received two submissions. It narrowed that down to one. It advertised that. Council really should make a decision on that.
Thank you. That's a straight answer.
All right, is everyone happy to move on? Okay, thank you. Item 8.2, it's in relation to proposed tree preservation order at Nursted Avenue in Bassendean. So again, our Director of Community Planning. Might just wait until there's some...
Apologies, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gibson? You're welcome to stay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. 8.2, this report is asking Council to consider making a tree preservation order over a tree on a property on Nurstead Avenue in Bassendean. The site is owned by the Department of Communities, and as such, the TPO will be of little effect for the reasons set out on page 11. But in any event, it is recommended that Council make the order.
Thank you. Any questions, Councillors? Councillor Gandil.
Thank you very much. In all seriousness, I think there is a grave concern that, as well-meaning as the council may wish to be,
I am asking a question.
Let me finish my preamble. As well-meaning as council may be, they can go too far. I've read the report.
So you want to
what is specifically special about this tree that warrants a tree preservation order? What is specifically special? Are we now saying cut blank,
where
we will list every single tree in
the
town?
The staff have addressed that issue.
Well,
they've said they form the view that the tree has aesthetic quality and provides a local food source for fauna, and as such is appropriate to consider a TPO.
So my question is then, what makes this tree different from any other tree in the town for a tree preservation order?
Through Madam Mayor, it has been nominated. That is what sets
that's apart. The requirement now.
And it is open to council through a scheme and policy settings to raise or lower the threshold.
Yeah.
To make it more or less difficult to have a tree preservation order.
Yeah. So my further question then is, with potentially this style of tree, now personally it's a personal view, granted everybody else has different views, it's not of significant value compared to any other tree in the town. Could this not then deter people from purchasing within the town if these sort of impingements are put on people with them having... So the owner says, no, I don't want it, and council... and we had the couple in the Brisbane Street, the council still impinges these requirements on individuals. Could that deter people from purchasing in the town?
Through you, Madam Mayor, that would, I suppose, be... issue for each individual purchaser, but at least in some cases, yes, it could be an imposition that they would not be willing to tolerate.
Thank you.
Councillor Ganger, just to remind you as well that even if there's a tree preservation order, it doesn't preclude the property owner from having a conversation with the staff when they're putting in a development application, and that tree preservation order could be removed. So, for example, in this instance, it's right at the front of the property, so development could still occur without it impinging on that. And I'd also like to remind you, the tree preservation orders were introduced when you were the mayor under the current local planning scheme.
Yep, and I believe every tree preservation order, which I believe was one under my time, was approved by the property owner that the tree was on.
This one is owned by the Department of Communities. Other questions, councillors? Okay, we'll move on to item 8.3. This is the Joint Development Assessment Panel application. So it's the amendment for the Bassendean Hotel. Mr Gibson...
Thank you, Madam Mayor. If I could just jump back to item 8.2 and just sort of clarify a point. It is open to council to set the threshold such that council will only make TPOs where it is supported by the owner. That is, that's an option for council. So if council wants to raise the threshold, that can be pursued.
Thank you.
But moving on to item 8.3, this supports asking council to consider a recommendation to the JDAP in relation to an amendment to the existing approval for the Bassendean Hotel. The proposal is reasonably straightforward in that it reduces the landscaping area as a means of providing additional car parking, but it is still compliant with the landscaping requirements of the scheme, and it will not impact on the retention of existing trees on site or the provision of new trees. So it is recommended that the proposal be supported.
Thank you. Questions? Okay, item 8.4, this is the existing carport and patio at 50 Faulkner Way, which the gentleman spoke to earlier. Again, this is Mr Gibson's, and I believe there were a number of issues that were raised in the deputation that you may like to address.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. Please remind me if I overlook any. This report is asking Council to consider an application for a development approval for an existing carport and patio. So I think that was one of the points that required clarification. The buildings are already there. Photos have been provided as part of the suite of attachments. The application has been assessed against the planning framework and is considered to be unacceptable. It is therefore recommended the council refuse the application, after which time the staff will commence compliance action to ensure the structures are removed. Alternatively, though, it is open to council to approve the application and allow the structures to remain in place.
So just the gentleman giving the deputation also, I believe, said that a development application had previously been submitted for these, which is not the case.
Through you, Madam Mayor, I believe he was referring to this application for development approval.
Okay.
Just explain that again.
Through you, Madam Mayor, previously they obtained building permits for the structures because the locations of the structures and the proposals generally were exempt from the requirement to obtain development approval. When they constructed them different to the building permit such that they would have required development approval.
That's what I thought.
A complaint comes to the town that instigates compliance action, which in turn leads to the applicant lodging an application for the existing development, which is already in place as evidenced by the photos.
So you said there's really two options in terms of it being approved and it can stay, or it's rejected and has to be removed. Is there another option where certain elements are removed? So, for example, I believe the largest shed, which has the houses, the boat, has side elements to it. Are there aspects that could be modified of the existing development to make it compliant?
Through you, Madam Mayor, those conversations have been had with the applicant. The applicant has, as I think set out in the report, asked for the application as it was lodged and it was constructed,
yep,
to be considered as is.
But if council doesn't accept it as is there scope for there to be modifications made without completely removing the structures?
Through you, Madam Mayor, potentially, so long as the scale of the changes are not so significant to change the nature of the application. It's not council's role to redesign their proposal for them. The application has been lodged. Council need to form a view about whether it's acceptable or not.
One more question, Councillor Humphrey. I understand there's also quite a number of other structures on the site that have been constructed that haven't had approval and are not compliant. Is that correct?
Through you, Madam Mayor, that's correct. When we received the development application and began assessing the application, there are a number of other patios that were already constructed on the site that didn't have development approval. The reason that they haven't been captured in this application is, firstly, when we requested that the applicant lodge this development application, it was on the basis of the non-compliant structures and the complaint that had been received. So we weren't aware of the additional patio structures at the time. When we did a review of the patio structures, some of them did comply, and the overall open space of the site does comply, so we didn't feel it necessary to require the applicant to lodge a separate development application for those patios on the basis that they were capable of approval. Mm-hmm. So this application only deals with the structures that don't comply.
Great, thank you. Councillor Hamilton.
So through the Chair, if the officer's recommendation is supported and we indicate that these structures are non-compliant, where does that leave the applicant with our planning department? Would there be some more conversations happening about possibly modifying the structures? I'm curious about where you would go if we support the officer's recommendation.
Through you, Madam Mayor, the starting point, I suppose, would be allowing the appeal period to run its course, because the applicant would have rights of appeal to the State Administrative Tribunal. If they, in fact, lodge an appeal, we'd have to obviously deal with that. But if they didn't, and the refusal stood, the next action would be effectively compliance action. There's nothing, though, stopping the applicant or the landowner from lodging a different application, one that may better respond to the concerns raised by the neighbour and town staff. Those conversations have already been had, but they pursued the application as lodged. But even if council refuses the current application, there is nothing stopping them lodging a subsequent application at a scaled-back proposal.
Okay.
Other questions, councillors?
Just with the setbacks, the shed that houses the boat, I did ask questions during the deputation. but I only looked at it from the street. It didn't look like there was any setback, but it's hard to tell from the street.
Through you, Madam Mayor, they're required to have a 1.5 metre setback from the secondary street, and the structure only provides a 1 metre setback. They're also required to have a 1.5 metre setback from the rear boundary abutting the group dwellings at the back, and they've only provided 0.5 metre setback. And then as soon as the structure was in the secondary street setback area, that's what triggered the application of local planning policy number 12 in terms of the other design requirements.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Worship. Just wondering, just in relation to the colouring and stuff, within the property, it looks like they've matched the colouring. So with the blue, so the fence is blue, the structures, the two structures are blue. I'm just wondering what you mean in the report when the colouring isn't correct. Do you mean the colouring to the roof of the house? So, I mean, even the awnings of the roof of the house look like they're blue as well. I'm just wondering what's not matching colour-wise.
Through you, Madam Mayor, the local planning policy requires the colouring of structures within the street setback area to completely match the materiality and the colour of the existing dwelling.
So you're talking about it need to be tiled roof?
The pillars of the structures would need to have masonry construction, so up to a third of it would be required to be pillars.
Yeah.
In regards to the roof structure, the pitch of the carport itself doesn't comply.
Mm-hmm.
When we met with the landowner out on site to discuss the patio structure,
yes,
we were generally comfortable because the pitch of that is gabled, so it mm-hmm. generally matched the dwelling.
Yeah.
And the compromise that we provided was that if they potentially painted the white colouring of the patio
mm-hmm.
to match the dwelling, it could be considered for approval by the town.
Yeah.
They were not prepared to alter the structure at all.
Oh, okay.
Anything further? Councillor Hamilton?
Sorry, I did read the report. Just remind me, I know what you've just said about the carport or structure, but the structure that houses the boat, what could they do with that? Because it seems to me that's the monster in the room, or in the street, if you'd like to.
Through you, Madam Mayor, one of the options that was requested was that they remove the sheet side panelling to reduce the bulk of the structure.
Mm.
And again, that's not something that the applicant was prepared to consider. They could also remove the first portion of the structure to increase the setback from the secondary street, which would again reduce the bulk as viewed from the corner, and that wasn't accepted.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, let's move on. Item 8.5 is the purchase of lot 304 Kenny Street in relation to Town Planning Scheme 4A. Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. This report simply seeks council approval to purchase a small portion of land that's required under TPS 4A. The site already accommodates a constructed footpath, and the matter is not contentious, as the town has already struck an in-principle agreement with the owner for the purchase of the site. So it's recommended that council purchase the site for $2,400.
Great, thank you. Any questions? Okay, 8.6, the proposed change of use to a use not listed for function centre and creative space. Again, Mr. Gibson, your item.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. This report is asking Council to consider application for development approval for a change of use for a site in the industrial area. It was advertised for public comment, which actually concludes on Friday. Obviously, the report will be updated if any further submissions are received. But in any event, the application has been assessed against the planning framework and is considered to be acceptable, subject to the imposition of a suite of conditions. It's therefore recommended that Council approve the application. As before, it's open to Council to take the contrary view and, in this case, refuse the application, but in doing so, we need to provide reasons that may be subject to a review as SAT.
Right, thank you. Yes.
Just a quick question. I note that there's a... somewhere in the report it says that you received one objection, and I think that was about noise, potential noise. Was that from a residential property?
Through you, Madam Mayor. Yes, it was over 200, just about 200 metres away from the subject site. One of the conditions that's been recommended is to cease amplified noise at 10 p.m. to ensure compliance with the noise regulations. The applicant hasn't opposed that condition. They've obviously read the item. But if they were to change the operating hours and seek amplified noise to, say, go to 12 o'clock, then they can simply put in a pre and post acoustic report demonstrating compliance with the noise regulations through various measures such as acoustic attenuation.
So can I ask, do you, as an officer, perceive that there would be a noise issue given how far away the residential properties are?
Through you, Madam Mayor, no.
Thank you.
Okay, item 8.7, the fencing local law periodic review.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. This report is asking Council to consider the local law relating to fencing. Whilst there's no issue with the current local law, Council needs to review it every 8 years. Which would be due later this year. In April, Council resolved to advertise its review of the local law with no changes. That occurred and no submissions were received. So it's recommended that Council finalise the review and schedule the next review for 8 years' time.
Thank you. Councillor Hamilton?
Just a quick one. At the very end of that I think it's actually in the attachments. At the very end of the attachments, the only mention of the type of fencing in Schedule 1, it is colourblind or corrigan, can't remember now, but it only mentions one type of fencing. But then further along in one of the other items, item 8.10, we talk about fencing again. So am I assuming that 8.10 covers variety of fencing compared to this local law?
Through Madam Mayor, the local law deals effectively with side fencing and builds on the requirements of the Dividing Fences Act. Item 8.10 deals with generally fencing in the front fence.
Right, okay. Okay, you're right. That was in there and I didn't pick that up. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so item 8.8 is the draft local heritage survey. Director of Community Planning, Mr. Gibson, once again.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. This report is asking Council to consider advertising a draft local heritage survey for the district. As you can see from the attachment, it is a large, comprehensive document, and it would be remiss of me not to acknowledge the work of the planning staff who have put in a big effort to produce such a comprehensive document. So, well done to Donna and her team. If ultimately adopted, this document would replace the current 2017 Municipal Heritage Inventory. The local heritage survey is just the new terminology, but it's largely the same thing. And it will be a comprehensive record of places with cultural significance across the district. Importantly, particularly given the size of the document, this is only for consent to advertise. And if Council does resolve to advertise, Council will get another chance to review it in the first half of 2022.
Thank you. I just had a question in relation to last time when it was the MHI. The town went out to the various property owners and contacted them. And my understanding is that at the time there was another letter sent that was communicating to the property owners about the potential for incentives and concessions and so on. And that created a bit of conversation amongst these property owners. I'm just wondering if we ever sort of closed out that process or whether there's been any further communication, being conscious of the fact we're going to email them all now, contact them all, and there's been no further discussion in the interim?
Through Madam Mayor, not quite sure what happened with the previous process because it's before both Donna and I was here, but Donna knows, so
It was included in the fees and charges in the planning section as an incentive for people whereby if they restored the property, they could make an application to have the development application fees refunded. Since that was included as a result of that action, it's only been used once.
Okay. I think there was more as well, though, but there were discussions around...
I'm not aware of the I'm aware of the proposal, but not the communications surrounding the proposal... I think in broad terms...
I'm not so worried about the proposal. I'm more just concerned about the communication and being mindful that there was something that was sent.
We can chase up what did occur or didn't occur. But the proposal was largely if people were willing to have their heritage site elevated, which there are issues with that proposal, and I'm not sure we'll be supporting that.
Yeah.
But in terms of the communication, to close that out, we'd have to follow up.
Okay, thank you. Councillor Hamilton.
Thank you to the staff for this very comprehensive document, which I haven't finished reading at all yet, so I will endeavour to do that this week. Can I just ask, on page 42 of the agenda, it states that these local heritage surveys are generally reviewed every 5 to 8 years. Now, we've reviewed it within 4 years. I'm just asking why we would review it sooner than we had to, given it's such a substantial document that requires so much work.
Is this in alignment with the review of the scheme and the strategy?
Okay.
And I, just before you go on, the comment that was made at the very end about the risk management implications versus if we don't endorse it, it won't meet the requirements of the guidelines. I was assuming that was in relation to reviewing it in alignment with the scheme and strategy.
So following on from your inquiry, Madam Mayor, I guess my curiosity, because clearly from a review point of view, there's no urgency because we're within the time frame. But if you needed to follow up, because my recollection is that, yes, there were incentives that were promised, a package of incentives that were promised.
They were undefined. It was a nebulous potential in the future. Yeah.
But I don't believe that that ever was formally created. So if there needs to be time to investigate that, is there any issues if this came back to us, say, next month to give you time?
Through you, Madam Mayor, they are completely separate. There is no need to conflate the two. The draft community funding policy, which is likely to be presented to Council next month, does actually provide, similar to what Donna referred to before, potential free refunds on application for skill application fees where people are undertaking upgrades or refurbishments to heritage sites. So that is a form of incentives, but the other incentives that were contemplated previously have issues in terms of their alignment with the planning system. So broadly, to answer your question, there is no need to defer this pending that other separate body of work. In any event, staff will follow up how that other body of work concluded and provide some advice to council and provide the board.
So did I read, correct me if I'm wrong, did I read somewhere in here that communication would be made with each of these listed properties or not?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's why I'm concerned about when you communicate with them about this body of work, whether you're going to get further comments about incentives that may or may not have been delivered. This is why I'm asking, that's all. It might not be combined in your mind, but it may well be combined in the minds of residents.
Through you, Madam Mayor, but I certainly accept that point, and I suppose we need to be quite specific in our language to make it clear what we are seeking comment on, but as sort of committed to the Mayor, we can certainly chase up those previously contemplated incentives and advise Council how that is.
Okay, correct. Thank you.
Anything further, Councillors? Okay, 8.9 is the licence agreement for the Telethon Community Cinemas. Again, Mr. Gibson.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. This is just a report seeking Council's approval of a new licence for the Telethon Community Cinemas. Councillors will already be across the background based on previous budget discussions, and this is simply to formalise the arrangement over the next two cinema seasons. It is proposed that we use the existing lease, but with some minor changes as set out in the recommendation, principally relating to non-disparagement. Non-disparagement.
Which is now a standard clause,
And also a requirement for the town to be acknowledged as a sponsor.
Okay.
Councillor Hamilton?
Okay. I've never been clear on what the $13,000 contribution from the town pays for. I've never been clear on that.
Through you, Madam Mayor, it's effectively a price they put on them bringing the cinemas to town.
Okay. Now, also, I note that we're being asked to provide additional option period over and above the next 2 years to so it'd be 3 years, if I'm reading the document correct.
The option to extend for a further 12 months?
Well, maybe I'm reading it wrong, but it looks like there's an additional option period of 12 months over and above the next 2 years. Is that correct?
Through you, Madam Mayor, it is correct, but it's a mutual option provision, so both parties would need to agree. So in other licences we have, there is effectively a one-sided option. This option would require both parties to consent.
Okay, that's okay then. Now, the other comment I have too is the booking system for the free screenings. It says there, councillor feedback. Typically, for residents, when they've gone onto that website for the community seminars, it shows that the free is full all the time. So many of us have provided feedback about that, how it's not adequate. But I note there that the town will investigate, explore other options to rectify this issue. I'm thinking, why are our staff going to explore options to fix something that the community seminars, they should have been fixing ages ago? I'm just curious about why that falls to our administration when it's on their website and they should be fixing it.
Through you, Madam Mayor, the issue is more of an issue for the town than the city. What we have at the moment is free screenings, tickets need to be pre-booked, but once you pre-book a ticket, if you are successful in pre-booking a ticket, there is no obligation to attend. And what we found on some instances is that people book the tickets, the best of intentions, presumably, but don't show up. Therefore, you've got a sellout on the books, but you've got less than 100% capacity on the ground. The other option would be potentially making a walk-up start and first in, best dressed. Now, the issue with that is that once you get to the capacity, you are turning people away. And we don't know how far away they've come from. And there's no neat solution that is absolutely risk-free, but that is the alternative. If that is council's preference, we can certainly raise those discussions with the cinemas. But it wouldn't be without risk, because at some point, the cinema operators would reach capacity and they would need to turn people who may well be residents of the town, turn them away and say they're not welcome to attend.
Okay, we're not going to solve
no, we're not.
The cinemas tonight. We know that there is an issue and staff will have a look at it. Okay, 8 to 10, draft amended local planning policy number 12, relating to developments within the street setback area.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. This report is asking Council to consider amended local planning policy relating to residential development. Council does have an existing policy, but that has not been reviewed since 2010. This policy seeks to simplify the control of residential development and, amongst other things, includes criteria regarding ancillary dwellings, outdoor living areas and outbuildings. The policy was circulated to councillors for feedback via the bulletin with no comments received. In any event, the report is simply asking council to authorise the advertisement of the policy for public feedback, and council will of course have another opportunity to consider the draft policy in light of any submissions either later this year or early next year. It is therefore recommended the council adopt the policy for the purposes of advertising.
Some time ago I had a conversation with you around the potential for various alternative housing options, I guess. Under this proposal, when it comes to ancillary dwellings, it has in here that there's the maximum plot ratio area of 100 metres square. If, for example, somebody wanted to do, say, two that were 50 metres square or three that were 33 metres square each, is that something that can be accommodated under this to provide, I'm not sure if I'm making myself very clear, but
I threw you, Madam Mayor. The residential design codes provide minimum and average site area requirements,
yep,
to determine how many dwellings can go on a site based on its zoning. So it's not to do with the plot ratio of the dwelling itself, it's to do with the land area and
mm-hmm.
what can be provided for under the zoning.
Right.
When it comes to the size of the dwellings that are proposed, if it's greater than 70 square metres, it becomes two group dwellings if there's an existing dwelling on the site.
Yep.
And whether you meet the minimum and average site areas for the zoning will determine whether or not you can have two group dwellings on the site.
Yep.
Whereas if you have a single lot that otherwise couldn't be subdivided into two, they can apply just to have an ancillary dwelling without subdividing the property. Mm-hmm. But what we're finding is people aren't choosing that option because they're saying that 70 square metres is too small. So providing it up to 100 square metres and varying the R codes will enable people to effectively have a small second dwelling on the property without circumventing the requirements of the minimum and average land area requirements.
So in that situation where someone opts for the 100 square metres, is there the possibility of that 100 square metres accommodating two dwellings? And I know you're saying most people want something larger, but I'm just thinking, you know, in terms of at the moment we have a particular issue with housing availability.
Yeah, the R codes only allow you to have one ancillary dwelling per lot, and it can't be contained on an existing group dwelling site. So where there's already two or more dwellings on the property, you're not allowed to have ancillary dwelling. Where there's a single house, you can have ancillary dwelling, and this is proposing to increase the size.
Mm-hmm.
If council was seeking to have multiple ancillary dwellings, we would need to add an additional clause in here that would permit more than one ancillary dwelling on a single lot, and that would need approval from the West Australian Planning Commission.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Councillor Hamilton.
Following on from that thought, does it become your thought about 100 square metre split down into 250 square metre property dwellings? If the proponent comes up with a creative way of joining those two properties with, say, a long hallway, is it classed then still as one property, one auxiliary dwelling?
Arthur, are you mad at Mayor? No, it isn't. And that's called dual key housing, which there's been a lot of compliance issues with. it's considered self-contained if it has its own kitchen and effectively its own plumbing for a laundry. So as soon as there's the plumbing outlets within the dwelling and it's clear that they could be separated by the door to create two separate dwellings under the same roof, they become two separate auxiliary dwellings.
That's interesting.
Okay, any other questions, councillors?
Can I just have the officers explain to me what our minimum open space requirements are these days for...
Through you, Madam Mayor, it depends on the R code of the property.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if it was zoned residential R20, like most of the town of Bassendean is, 50% open space.
Right.
Okay, everyone happy?
I do have one more.
You go.
One more. Page 3 of Attachment 8 mentions outdoor living areas, and I'm curious about point C1.1.2, that an outdoor living area in a street setback area must be demarcated via paving or fencing, and I'm curious about other alternatives to demarcate that, like, for instance, hedges and things like that. It seems very specific about what has to demarcate that area, and I'm curious why.
Through you, Madam Mayor, the issue that we're having at the moment is when parent lots are subdivided, the rear fence usually goes abutting the existing dwelling, and so that leaves no option to have the required usually 36 square metre outdoor living area, which was previously in the backyard. There's no longer any room for it. But under the model subdivision conditions, they're required to upgrade the existing dwelling to comply with the requirements of the code, which would otherwise require an outdoor living area of that size in the rear setback area, and also accessible via habitable room from the dwelling, which is where we run into issues, because then we need to modify the facade of the existing dwelling to punch through doors that otherwise weren't there, just to have it accessible from the what may have been the original lounge room. When it comes to demarking the area at the front, the West Australian Planning Commission needs to be satisfied that that area is used as outdoor living area, as opposed to just an area of front yard. and the way we've attempted to address that requirement is to prescribe fencing or paving treatment, so it's clearly distinguishable from the balance of the front yard as an outdoor living area. We have had instances in the past where we've, applicants have sought subdivision clearance to create an area out the front that wasn't demarcated just by use of hedges and sedges, and subdivision clearance wasn't obtained. So we think this is a way that you could delineate an area as an outdoor living area whilst making sure that the facade of the original dwelling isn't impacted.
Sorry, if I could just add on to that. This, through Madam Mayor, is simply providing an alternative deemed to comply. As with all of these provisions, there is also the design principle. So if an applicant doesn't comply with the existing deemed to comply or the alternative deemed to comply, there is each application is considered on its individual merits as guided by the design principles. So it is not a hard no. It is just simply saying these are the ways of getting a deemed to comply tick in the box, effectively. But if they fail on both fronts, they are still able to obtain a design principle assessment.
I'm sure you'd be very happy to see creative and innovative things coming across your desk, but never mind.
Okay, item 8.11 refers to FOGO in schools. Mr. Campbell?
So the town introduced FOGO into some residential properties in July 2020, becoming the first council north of the river to introduce the 3-year FOGO system, educating the users of the service about what can go into FOGO being and recycling being is important in ensuring the transition is a success. Officers have started to engage with schools to educate students to bring the message in from the schools from home. And a key aspect of this is to have the same bin system in the school as the students use at home. The current state government contract, called the Common Use Agreement, or CUA, does not include FOGO as a service. Schools can negotiate to receive a FOGO service with the contractors on the CUA, or a local government can provide the service at no charge, where it's not service in the CUA. This report proposes to provide each school within the town with up to six FOGO bins at no charge. The total cost of this is $6,720 in waived FOGO charges.
Thank you, and thank you for answering my questions yesterday. Councillor Hamilton?
So $6,720 per annum for all seven schools, up to six FOGO bins per school. Can I ask if this charge, I can see where the CEO has delegated authority to waive this, but can I ask if this would be reviewed annually or not?
Yes, it could be as part of the delegations register.
The only reason I ask if it can be reviewed annually, because clearly, as you've stated in your report, state government haven't quite caught up, but eventually when they do catch up, it would be nice if they could actually pay some fees for this service.
When the CUA is adopted by updated with FOGO, the school will be obligated to receive that service from the CUA providers.
Yeah, okay, cool.
Councillor Gangell?
Thank you. Do we have an understanding of when that might be, that state government will roll out FOGO to state schools? I suppose it's Amber Jade Sanderson now, the Minister. Not Stephen Dawson.
One of your colleagues, maybe, Councillor Gangell.
Indeed, and I'm just wondering if we have, I suppose there's no indication there, but maybe we should pressure the state government.
We have a discussion with the Department of Finance.
Yeah.
And it's in the CEO will have a review.
Okay. Two questions. The cost of it, I realise it's, I suppose, relatively small, but considering our state of our budget, it's not a small amount. How capable are we able to absorb this cost each year?
So the $6,720 we could potentially accommodate in the waste budget through some of our contingencies that we include in there for service growth.
Mm-hmm.
Often when we have a service start or finish, there's a little bit of lag time between when that charge comes off, so there is a little bit of
One last question, I think, for Mr. White. Are we still allocating funds to the Comfortable Care program?
Actually, we have a contract with them, didn't we, for a certain period of time?
I'm not both of them.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
My understanding is that we had a contract where there was a certain period of time we were obligated for.
Mm.
Yeah?
In terms of this funding, though, my understanding of it is it's really an extension of our education of FOGO, so that the younger children are taking that information home and reinforcing it, and there's a consistent message across the whole waste sort of education.
Yeah, we do allocate some funds for school in school education. They're run by service providers, SUAS or by EMIC. That's usually not expanded each year.
Thank you. Everyone happy? Okay, 8.12, it's a proposal for traffic management on railway parade following a community request. Mr Adams?
Thank you, Madam Mayor. and the purpose of this report is to consider undertaking community consultation on the implementation of local area traffic management treatment on railway parade between Lord Street and 2nd Avenue. The town received some complaints a few months ago on speeding along Railway Parade and a request to investigate the issues. The office investigated the complaints and found, and in line with the Town Planning and Built Environment Policy number 1.2, Traffic Management Treatment Policy and Guidelines, found there to be some speeding issues, albeit slight, as detailed in the report. As detailed in the report, the town has landed on option one, which is rubber speed cushions. But throughout the process, we did investigate alternative options, including chicanes with tree plantings in the centre. We found them to be not viable due to distant constraints. It would also include, we've got some detailed maps there which isn't included in the report, but the detailed maps show that we would probably remove more trees than we would plant. There's also cost implications along with the site implications. The site is too constrained to put them, to install them. The design requires, Railway Parade is a bus route, so the design requires to meet requirements for buses, so the chicanes are required to be quite wide. They would impact upon the footpath on one side, the boundary also on one side, along with the dual-use path on the other. Any questions?
Well, thank you for the opportunity that I had yesterday to discuss with you and explore the other options. And I think, councillors, you have a copy on the table of the proposal that wasn't deemed to be viable, which I understand that's what we've been, our preferred method of traffic management would be, if possible. I'm just wondering, in the conversation I was able to have with you yesterday, there was discussion around the existing policy and the potential to review the policy before we necessarily make a decision on this particular issue. What are your thoughts on that approach?
We're in the process of reviewing the policy. It's up for review along with quite a few others. So that's also an approach that would be acceptable.
And the other question, so in the officer recommendation, it's proposing to fund option one, which is the speed cushions, for $30,000. Do you know if that is currently included in the draft budget?
We've had discussions with it, and if it goes through, I suppose, tonight, then we're continuing including it.
There's funds available. Whether or not it's been funded now, given this, the process to go through and the subsequent decision to be made,
Having had a look at the budget documents that were sent through about 4 weeks ago, I think, in the bulletin, this was a project that had been withdrawn subject to funding, if I'm correct. And I'm pretty sure that was what we agreed to in a workshop.
So that's what you mean, subject to funding?
There's two items on the spreadsheet, and it's the one that has subject to funding on it. So it's actually, it was in a workshop. We discussed this ages ago.
I just wasn't sure.
And it was, so in the spreadsheet that I've got from a month ago, it's actually got subject to funding on it. There's two of them together, different projects. But so getting back to the report, I'm just a little bit confused about page 61 of the report. There's a little box down the front bottom there that shows speeding or what have you. It's supposed to be two different addresses, but they've both got number 38. So I'm just hoping that someone can clarify for me whether that speed test was done at two different addresses or not, because both boxes have 38 on them.
To you, Madam Mayor, they were done at two different addresses, yeah.
Okay. Now, my other understanding as well is that in Anzac Terrace, where the rubber speed cushions have been installed, certainly as a councillor, I've listened to complaints about those rubber speed cushions. Mr. Adams, do you have any concerns about the potential for complaints arising from this if they're installed?
To you, Madam Mayor, I suppose I'm concerned about complaints, probably more concerned about complaints if we don't install anything. I know, you know, I'd much prefer to take on the, do tree planting, do that psychological traffic control where you're putting things in people's peripheral vision. I'd much rather be doing that, but even if we could fit it in this location, we are also talking about large amounts of money. So for bang for buck to make the roads safer, I think the speed cushions are a good option. We will concede that we will receive some complaints in regards to the speed cushions. Yep, they're around the town already, and we don't receive that many complaints, although we receive the occasional one. And they're utilised throughout local areas like this for this type of reason. They're effective, they don't affect the bus route, and they're cheap, and they do last, and they are a proven method.
Councillor Gansel?
Yes, thank you. Just in relation to that, I have to say I concur with Councillor Hamilton. They haven't been received the best of traffic calming devices. Just when you say they last, certainly that they do tend to flatten over a period of time. And I think Fitzgerald Street is a great example where when they were yay-high and now they're basically almost to the road level. What's the period of time, considering you have some pretty heavy movement of vehicles, haulage along that road? What would you anticipate the expectancy of the cushions to be?
To you, Madam Mayor, I think the cushions have improved in durability over the years, and from the recent cushions that I've seen installed, they are lasting a lot longer. So I would expect these to last 5 to 10 years without a problem.
Councillor Hamilton?
Given that we have a close working relationship with police and Kiara, has there been consideration given to asking the police to do speed traps and monitors along that stretch? Because I know that they've been doing Iolanthe and have been very successful in reducing the speeding along there. So is there potential to actually look at asking our local police force to perhaps put some speed traps along there on occasions to maybe see if over a period of time that assists in reducing the general speeding along that stretch?
Yes, thanks, Councillor Hamilton, and to you, Madam Mayor. That's one of our standard practices. And I would assume that the police are there in Iolanthe because of our instigation or that from the general public. So we're out doing speed counts all the time around the town, and we're in constant communication with the police and letting them know where we're finding speeding. So that's something that we would have done, yeah.
Councillor
Councillor Ganger?
Just on that, just noting, I use railway parade quite frequently, just the time do we have a time frame when speeding was prominent? Because in the mornings it's very congested, in the afternoons it's very congested. So I'm assuming there's a period there, probably say from 7:30 through to maybe 7 in the morning where it's more of a free run. Do we find any particular times were higher than others?
Thanks, Councillor. Yeah, through you, Madam Mayor, I don't have that detail there, but we do have that times. And what I've found with other areas is you do get hooning during the day where there's low traffic. So that's the normal state of affairs. So I'm just assuming that that's the case.
So
there,
after the peaks or the morning afternoons,
that's usually what we find. And you know what we generally find as well is that the there's people at home during the day and they're noticing the speeding and then they complain. And you know my perception is that they'll notice the hooning of people getting up above 80. And then they find that unacceptable, lodge the complaint. We put in the speed counters and we get the results that we get.
Final question, yes?
Do we have any... I've noticed them in some other local authorities where they have like a message board that notes the speed of the oncoming vehicle and says, you're speeding, slow down. Do we have anything like that in our little... artillery?
Yes, we do. Yep. And we do apply it. Yep.
It's just I go down Railway Parade regularly and I've not been clocked for speed.